You're listening to Truly Sustainable Sarasota. My name is Emily. My co-host is Vicky. And we have some interesting guests lined up today.
Yes, we do. We have some wonderful guests. We have Galen Chadwick and Rural Chapel, and they're calling in from the Ozarks. And Rural is one of the members of the Ozark Mountain Daredevils, and we'll hear from the Ozark Mountain Daredevils music a little bit later. But they are co-founders of an organization called WellFedNeighbor.com. And hi, guys.
Hey, we're having a little trouble hearing you. Can you hear us okay?
We can hear you just fine.
Okay, great. Well, we were on speakerphone here. We heard you fine when you answered the phone, but you're a little bit in the background right now.
Well, as long as you can hear what we say to you, that's the important thing. But more important is that you guys are coming out loud and clear, and you're the ones our audience wants to hear from. So. Not us. They hear us every week. So
I'll tell you what. My name is Rural Chapel, and I'm going to give to Galen to start off with. And Galen was the founder of the movement, and then came to me, and I'm kind of the second in command and second in line. And so anyway, I'm going to take it off speakerphone and give you to Galen here.
Thank you. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Galen Chadwick from WellFed Neighbor. Thanks for calling in this morning.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So tell us what WellFed Neighbor is and what inspired it.
Well, what it is, I think our motto says it best. Your best defense against hard times is a well-fed neighbor. This is prompted, the movement was prompted by the discovery that there's not a county in the state that can feed its own population, much less the teeming metropolitan areas of Kansas City and St. Louis. I'm talking a rural state that's used to feed itself and millions of others besides. And we started looking around, and that holds true for all the states around us.
Now, Galen, that sounds to me like a very radical statement because... Well, not to me, because I know, but I think to a lot of people that would be a very radical statement, because most of us think of our farm country as the breadbasket of the world. They think we feed the world. So can you qualify that a bit?
Yeah. Well, right now, fully one-third of all of our agricultural land in America is given over to the production of ethanol, corn, and that's used for either ethanol or for cattle feed.
One-third?
Yeah, one-third of it, and the Central Valley around Bakersfield, California, has been completely shut down. There's 10,000 farmers or more that have all been thrown out of work. They've cut off the water, and there's just nothing but dust bowl desert out there now, tumbleweeds. That fed one-fourth of the nation's fruit and produce. That's offline. The last of the wheat reserves were sold 2 months ago. There's no wheat, there's no food on store for 320 million people. I could go down the list. We've lost 20% of our dairy farmers in the last 18 months. There's a wholesale collapse across every sector of the economy, pretty much the farm economy. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but we boil it down to the fact that here in Missouri, most all of our food is trucked in from thousands, you know, comes from the coast, brought in by truck thousands of miles away. And it's all dependent on a fragile oil-based supply line. If that's broken for any reason, we've got 3 days' worth of food here. And what's plan B? We woke up to the fact there is no plan B. Neither academicians or politicians have anything other than a status quo mentality. They more or less are basing everything on the assumptions that the world's not going to change very much. And given the times that we live in, I don't think that's a particularly responsible perspective to hold on to.
Well, when did WellFed Neighbor come about?
Well, it officially launched on January 3rd of this year, and we're now a statewide movement. The idea basically struck me, it's almost a year to the day, Becky. It's really interesting. It's October 11th last year. We're coming up on our one-year anniversary of just launching this idea. And the challenge was to do that without money, without grants, without an organization. In fact, I hardly knew anybody in the town. But I've always held on to the belief that a There's nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come.
Were you raised on a farm yourself, Galen?
Wasn't raised on a farm. I have agricultural patent, and I'm a master gardener, and I've done gardening and farming and, on a small scale, hobby scale, much of my life. I have been involved in commercial avocado, citrus, asparagus, strawberry, growing of these various crops here and in Australia. So I can't say that I grew up on a farm, but I could say that it's just part of my inclination and avocation, I suppose, it's in my blood.
And so what does Well-Fed Neighbor do?
Well, we had a rural and urban strategy. The urban strategy began with the 1,000 Gardens campaign. When we launched on January 3rd, I threw up a challenge, invited some friends, and the word got out. About 100 people attended a banquet, launched the movement, and I threw out a challenge. I said, let's start 1,000 gardens before Earth Day. That's April 22nd. This is to more or less bring the awareness to the people and here in the city. And by Earth Day, we had been credited with growing or starting some 3,500 gardens. So I guess we're more or less leading with ideas and with action. It's all volunteer action, but, that was part of it. The second answer is our rural strategy is to create the Well-Fed Neighbor Farm Co-op. We're preparing to organize the 27 counties around Springfield, which is our economic and our food shed as well. So I'm let Rural speak to that, because he's been, Rural Chapel has been leading this, of how to integrate this into our supermarket chains. And he's just brilliant. We've already got an agreement with a major chain here to buy all the locally grown produce and value-added products that we can get out of these hills here. So that's just a quick overview.
Galen, I have a question. I'm Emily, Vicky's co-host. When you say that you managed to start 3,500 gardens, what does it actually take to get people motivated to do that? And are you literally having to physically give them seed or go and give them training?
No.
Or how do you get it going?
It's more or less through the... We had a series of radio interviews, TV, a lot of press, and we had various churches and organizations step forward. So the first of the 1,000 gardens, as a matter of fact, was created at the Ozark Empire Fairgrounds, the big stadium here in town that was dedicated to agriculture originally. And so the first of our 1,000 gardens was there. The director of the Parks Department was there. And so it was as much publicity, and then working with the neighborhood association presidents and volunteers from schools. I would say it was more of a coordination and an inspiration than physically picking up shovels and doing putting seeds in the ground, although I did personally work on 3 gardens this year as well, including one large church garden. So I think it's like an onion. You can kind of focus on almost any level you want, but the main thing was that we had people there at all levels. I hope that answered your question.
Yes, it does.
Galen, I do want to talk to Roy. I want to say Dave, who has the show right before us, the very first show he did on the station when the station was born about 3.5 years ago, or going on 4 years, I guess, by now, was an Ozark Mountain Daredevil song.
Well, I'll let Rule speak to the Ozark Mountain Daredevils. He's I'm not going to presume to try to teach Mozart how to whistle. Why don't you talk to Rule about these things?
Okay.
I'm going to hand the phone over to Rule here. Hello.
Hi, Rule. Did you hear what I told told Galen?
No.
The show right before us is called The Eclectic Blender, and the programmer's name is Dave, and the very first song he played when he started his show 4 years ago was an Ozark Mountain Daredevil song.
You are kidding.
And he was just thrilled that I had someone from the Ozark Mountain Daredevils on our show today.
Well, that is wonderful. Well, thank you for the opportunity. It's great music, and still, a lot of the guys are still in this area, and they still tour. I don't tour all the time with them. I'm going to play with them in November here, but it's a great, it was a great band, great music, and I think the song that we talked about is perfect, kind of sums up the whole situation.
Well, and we found that song. You made it right. Emily, do you want to play it now, and then we'll go back to talking about WellFedNeighbor.com? Rule, would you like to tell us what the song was?
Well, this band was kind of, it was definitely hill music, you know, and
it was
based around the based around where we live, and you know, and the theme that I like from the song is that, you know, that everything was made right the first time. We didn't have to modify it, and we didn't have to genetically adapted for efficiency, and we didn't have to do all that stuff. All we had to do was just grow what was there. And since what we like to call the golden age of Missouri, and actually it correlates across the United States. I mean, it's not in just Missouri, and that's the point, that we're trying to create a template here that other communities, other counties, other states, other parishes can adapt to, and then not only reestablish their food supply, but also reestablish their local economies. But the fact of the matter was, during our home, during the years of 1890 through 1914, we grew the food in this region that not only fed our state, but fed the country as it existed back to the East Coast. And to a large degree, and then during World War II, that expanded to the point that we had some 200 tomato canneries here, and we produced and exported tomatoes to the world. And now, 95 years later, we're surrounded by a fescue desert. We basically all we produce is hay, and our point to the people is that, you know, unless you're prepared to eat hay after 3 days, we need to do something different. And I mean, literally, that's the truth. I mean, if something were to happen, even as simple as this flu pandemic that's going around the country. I mean, during 19, we don't ever try to scare people. It's not that, but I mean, in World War II, the flu epidemic of that period, World War I, the flu epidemic of that period killed 50 million people and left, you know, the supply lines for food and water and everything were just totally disintegrated. And because people were afraid of people bringing the flu to different, and so they just stopped trucks rolling, they stopped, you know, there was just no commerce, there was nothing. And, should something like that happen, we have a whole Midwest of the United States that has no food.
Now,
go ahead.
How did we get in this shape? I don't know if you or Galen wants, which of you wants to respond to this, but how did this happen?
I have a lot of European friends, and they all, it used to be a big joke, but now it's really coming home to roost. And my European friends will say, "Rule, the Americans fear most?" And I'd say, "I don't know." And they'd say, "Inconvenience." I mean, and that pretty much sums up our American society. We have gotten so used to having it so easy and not having to grow any food, we just ran to the get and go, or we ran to the grocery store and we got our milk and we got our bread and we got everything that we needed, and we ran home and then we watched TV all night long. And really, I mean, you know, people will come in today from an 8-to-5 shift and they'll just be exhausted, and you know, but I mean, really, I mean, you know, we have a lot of friends that are Amish and Mennonite, and there are a host of others, but those peoples Germanic in origin are they're self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
They don't they produce all their own energy, they produce and distribute all their own water, all their own food. They do business inside their community, and they need nothing from us, you know. The scary thing to them is, should food go offline, they have millions of hungry Englishmen surrounding them. So they have consented to help us train farmers. And which really gets back to the thing is, you were asking how this has happened. It is in our constant apathetic approach to life that everything has to get easier, and cheaper. And basically what we've done is we've allowed large corporations to come in and sell us everything, whereas our main streets used to be populated with individual businesses that did that. And we've allowed them to take our local economies from us, and now they're after food. I won't mention any names, but you know, that's, you know who we're talking about. I mean, you go to the large stores in your community, and they can price food lower, and they, of course, you don't know where that food comes from. I mean, 75-80% of it comes from overseas, mm-hmm. and the same percentage of it is GMO, is genetically modified. And so anyway, it is all about efficiency, and that's where Americans have come. What we're trying to teach Americans is you have to secure your food supply. That's first. If you do that, and then you put farmers back online, which have to be trained first because there's no young farmers. This is scary. The mean age of a farmer in our state, and I'll bet you'd find the same to be true where you are. The mean age of a farmer in our state is 67 years old.
You know, here in Sarasota, there's a college called New College, and the young people there are very, very aware of environmental things and food. And we have a farm not far from us, not far from south of Sarasota, called Warden Farm, and it's run by two young farmers who both have PhDs.
Wonderful.
And they have decided that the to be farmers was a lot more worthy than anything else they could do. And they do the most wonderful, just heavenly produce you can imagine.
And the reason it is wonderful and heavenly is because that was the way, you know, I get jumped on all the time. I happen to be a Christian. I'm not a church-going, you know, I'm not there every time the door opens, but I had a guy jump me the other day. And this is another thing we're trying to get away from, is this political, you know, where you can, you know, don't offend anybody. I said, let's just say the truth and I'll get along. You know, I mean, the thing is this, you know, I said something like, I just slipped and said, God bless the other day. God bless you guys or whatever. And, you know, it was a totally innocent thing, but this guy, young kid, called me and said, well, you know, you shouldn't, God has nothing to do with food. And I said, whoa, that's personally, you know, I don't feel that way. Now, maybe you do. And he said, well, you can't interject God into this deal. And I said, well, sure I can. It's just like, you know, you have long hair and I'm shaved head. I'm, you know, it's just as much part of me as your hair is of you, you know. And he said, well, how would you feel if someone said, you know, Allah's blessings be upon you? And I'd say, thank you. Because we need Allah too. We need Allah and his guys. And if you don't believe in God, we need you. You know, that's the point. It's all inclusive. No one, I mean, but, you know, everyone needs to, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I'm trying to paint the picture that the reason we're where we are is because we have been apathetic and we've allowed ourselves to be kept in this kind of trance by political correctness, political stuff in general. It's all a distraction. It's just the huge distraction. And so Galen and I have been working without political help, without political money, without anything, just working across the state. And because of that, we were in the governor's office last week. And I'm sure they just want to know what in the world we're doing and how we're getting the funding for it. You know, we're just going to people and we're trying to get them to understand that you need gardens in town, like in 1942, when 42% of the food came from people's homes. They
42%.
Grew it in their yard and they canned it and they ate that canned food during the winter. No one does that now.
Rule, you mentioned that you know a lot of, or in touch with a lot of Mennonites and Amish people, and going back to the GMO situation. One thing that is very, very important is that people actually keep seeds and that they try to get heirloom seeds and hold on to those.
Exactly.
Are you finding, because we do have places like Monsanto that are trying to create the seeds that basically you have to buy them each year. You can't store them.
Exactly.
I forget what they call them, terminator seeds. Are you finding that in those communities, at least like with the Mennonites, that they're able to do that and bypass the genetic industry?
Yes. And actually, that is one of our biggest pushes, is saving seed. We're trying to get people, and I'm going to, in just a minute, I'll turn you back over to Galen, because we're getting really technical and now into agriculture. But I do know enough to say that one of our biggest pushes is to get people to save their seed. Off of every plant you plant, take a few of the fruit let the plant go to seed. Save that seed, and then you can use it next year, because the government is hurriedly rushing to make that illegal. And we have a bill now in the Missouri state, or no, in the Senate, that has already been passed. And I'm so glad that you have allowed us to do this, because we are trying to get this news far and wide. There is a bill called the Food Safety Enhancement Act. And this is a testament to just how little our elected officials read anything. These people start this legislation, they name it, and I'm a marketing person, that's what I do, so I know how this works. It's called the Food Safety Enhancement Act. Well, there can't be anything wrong with that, can there?
No, that sounds wonderful. Sounds like what we all need and want.
Yeah, and it's all done under the guise of keeping food safe for people. But this bill, 2749, has passed the House of Representatives already and is in the Senate to be passed now. And the thing is that if we do, it will levy a $500 fee on every small producer nationwide. It will also allow the government to come in and categorize and catalog what they grow, how they do it, and basically it's all under the guise of keeping food safe for people. Well, a homegrown tomato never killed anybody.
Mm-mm.
It's the food that the big four send us that does. And, as far as a terror threat, if anyone wanted to do anything and kill a bunch of people, they wouldn't try to poison 4 million backyard farms and small producers. They go to one source that feeds hundreds of millions, and so it is total spin. And it was introduced by a lady that her husband works for Monsanto. And we find the scary thing is, I didn't know until Galen started showing me, but most of the people in our government have at one time worked for Monsanto.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
There you go. It's nothing but lobbying and big money, and they want to own food. I mean, the government years ago gave them the right to go to our seed bank and patent all the seeds.
No.
They already own thousands of patents. I mean, and I would suggest that your listenership get food. Have you seen The Future of Food?
Yes, we have.
Great. And there's another one out called Food Inc.
Food Inc., yes. That was playing here for a while. I'm not sure if it's still playing here, but it was a
great.
Very good...
And then there's a movie called Fresh that you have to get. And you can get it off the Internet, but, someone should be showing it. And but it is a great, great movie.
So you can just Google Fresh, the movie or something. How do you get that? Do you know how to get it?
Yeah, you just Google it, and it is produced in our part of the country. Actually, it was produced by a lady from across the ocean. I do not know where from. Whis, Galen says, it has a lot of it has Diana Endicott's co-op in it, and in Kansas City, and we are currently working with Kansas City, Springfield, St. Louis, because they're the three big metropolitan areas in our state. And it just tells a story that the scary part is that it's been said before, you own fuel, you own oil, you own the economies, you own food, you own the people, and that's it. That it is just that simple. If someone owned your food, that you were a slave.
Mm-hmm.
So we are pushing for state sovereignty of food and energy. And the reason we want to do that is because no man should control what another man grows or have anything to do with what he does with it. 2749, it's H.R. 2749, and I can't say it enough. Please, 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 everybody, get on the phone or email or whatever to the Senate and tell them not to pass it. And because if it goes into law, then, you know, the government will have oversight over every small producer, and that means backyards. And the stipulation is this: they will not do a thing to you if you use 100% of the produce that you grow. Now, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Except for the fact that if you sell it, they'll be on your doorstep, and if you give it away, they'll be on your doorstep.
Mm.
So that's the way they've legislated this, where it sounds meek and mild, but it is not. And everybody ought to get online and read the bill.
So, and what is it again? What's the name? What's the number again? 4721.
H.R. 2749.
2749. I know a lot of small urban growers, and just even myself, I sell at the local farmers market. And I sell my fruit or excess greens or whatever I have. And that would be horrible if I couldn't do it. That's part of how I...
How you live.
Yeah, yeah.
In a very small way.
But.
We are, and the thing is this, I am the marketing kind of side of this, and I want to let Galen, I don't know how long we have, but I definitely want Galen to talk more about the technical end, but my goal is this: I want to relocalize food, secure it in every area. Your town, your local community should have its own food, and so should every local community across the United States. Now, what happens is this: when you do that, then you get farmers that then sell that produce inside the metro area. That dollar, every dollar produced for that, goes through the economy six times. When you go to a big box store and shop, it goes, it exits, it's gone. You know, so we need to do, the key to the whole thing is doing business local. And that's not just food, that's with everything. Are you going to pay a little more for it? Sure. But the point is, it helps your economy, and a rising economy floats all boats. So what our message across the United States is, food and jobs.
I have one question, and Emily has one too, but what I've been curious about, and we didn't get to talk about it, is how you got the local supermarkets to carry local food, because most supermarkets are chains and they won't sell local food. Everything has to go through some corporate headquarters somewhere else.
Right, right. Well, now here's how we did it, and I would suggest it worked really well. First, you have to realize that there is a trend nationwide for healthy, locally grown food. Yet there is a growing trend. We found that out when we went to Diana Endicott in the city to her Good Natured Farms co-op that has about 150 farms in it, and they supply, you can Google all this, by the way, and it's really good to look up, but they supply grocery stores called Hen Houses and Price Chopper.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they are owned by a guy in Kansas City. His name is Ball. You want to source out your local grocery stores first, and it is a perfect way for them to fight off the big guy. So you make an agreement here in town with us. It was Harder Houses. We have other locally, just small markets. They are full providers, but they're locally owned. So we went to them first and said, you know, here's the trend. We just showed them the business data. You know, here's what will bring new people to your store is if you start carrying local produce. So they saw the value. I mean, we just presented a business plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to fight Walmart, then you need to offer local food. And we're not trying to tell anybody what to do, and we're not trying to drive big stores out of business. What we are asking for is the opportunity to compete. When they say, and you go to a Walmart or a Sam's, you will see the word locally grown. Well, that comes with a huge disclaimer, and God knows where that comes from. I mean, that's locally at their definition. So we want to compete on that word. Oh, local? Well, where local is that? Oregon? You know,
mm-hmm.
Samoa? Where is that? You know? So
So, and then we can say our local is within 150 miles. Okay, you know, and so we just want to compete, you know, health and nutrition. Is yours GMO? Ours isn't. We just want to compete. That's what we want to do. And we believe that we have the trend and we believe we have the momentum. And we just want our government to allow us to do that. In America, that ought to be possible.
Rule, so, I just want to add also that when someone buys from a big store, whether it's Walmart or even some of the big health food chains, they are putting pressure most of the time on the farmers, and they label stuff organic, but they put a lot of pressure on the farmers to lower their prices in order to be
exactly.
able to be in their big stores. And when you get places, a lot of these places are also helping to lower the standards of what's considered organic. So it really
exactly.
is totally better to buy literally locally grown from the person down the street or the farmer's market, where you can know a little bit more about who's growing it and what they're growing it with.
Exactly, exactly. That is the point. We want more and more people are wanting to know where their food comes from, what it is. They want to know what it is. And we believe that, you know, we can't even talk about a health care plan until we start eating better food. We know for a fact that, of course, the government will not admit this, but because they gave the green light to Monsanto and others to grow GMO food. It never went through testing, mm-hmm. like a drug. And by the way, that if you saw, you know, the future of food, you realize that GMO, that, you know, when they genetically modify, so they have to use a virus to get that genetically modified gene into the cell.
Yes.
And that it's salmonella, it's something, but it's a virus.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I personally just rather have regular corn, you know. And the thing is that a lot of other people are the same way. And what we've noticed was in the past 15 years since we've been eating this almost totally, you go in a grocery store, almost everything you eat is 75% of it is GMO corn, wheat, or soy. And that means everything. That means ketchup, that means mustard, that means, you would not believe, we have depleted the varieties of food we eat down to about 12 seed varieties from millions. And, I mean, it's just, in the last 15 years since we've been eating this produce, this corn, this soy, this GMO product, we have seen fourfold increases in food allergies, autism, juvenile diabetes, obesity, tons of things. Now, the correlation's there. Is there proof? No. But the correlation's there. And we believe that local, healthy food will not only increase our economy, produce the jobs we need. I mean, if we can get our school systems and our hospitals and our prisons and in our grocery stores to buy local food, and then we can rise to the occasion and produce it, we pump immediately hundreds of millions of dollars into every local community that stays there. No one goes without a job then. You know, there's plenty of jobs for all, and that's what we're trying to teach people, is you can't, we are being gutted. Our local economies are being gutted to serve a world economy, and we don't want to do that. We want local, secure local food, and we want a secure local economy, and that's all. I mean, it's not tree hugger stuff, and it's not doomsday scenario stuff. It's just real. We just want, you know, we believe that locally grown food. If you're a businessman, I can sell it to you by just saying, look, if we put locally grown food back online, we build an economy that will help your business. And every one of them will say, sure, let's do it. There's just no downside to it. So I'm sorry for ranting on, but we're kind of passionate about this.
No, that's great, Rule. You made some wonderful points. We just have a few minutes. Do you want to get Galen on?
Yeah, let me put Galen back
on. Okay.
Thank you all so much for the song.
Thank you.
So,
and we have another one I think we're going to close with.
Oh, today. Cool. Well, and if you get a chance, please keep in touch with us and let us know how we can help in your area.
And we'll have you on again, for
Thank
sure.
Thank you. Hold on. Here's Galen.
Okay. That was Rural Chapel.
Hey,
hi, Galen. Galen Chadwick. So we just have a few more minutes before we have to close. But I remember you told me the percentage of of types of produce that have gone extinct that were at one time commercial.
Oh, yeah.
What is that?
Oh, boy. This is coming from the World Food Atlas. 100 years ago, of course, the gardens and farms and everything were just overflowing. We had 7,000 varieties of apples at that time. In the intervening years, we have lost 97% of all the fruit and vegetable varieties that existed. They're gone. They're extinct due to industrialized agriculture.
Now, that is terrifying.
The commonwealth of the people is not a single bottom line. It's a triple bottom line. And our industrialized, militarized agriculture has destroyed all but a single bottom line. The only thing efficient about it has been the largest mass migration in history of the farmer to the city, where we're becoming fed into total helplessness. Now, in this incredibly diverse and abundant state 100 years ago, one out of every six people in the state is now on federal food assistance. I could go on and on.
Galen, I think a lot of our listeners know the importance of biodiversity, why it's so important to have so many food varieties. But can you explain it just briefly in case someone doesn't understand why it's important to have so many varieties of apples or different crops?
Well, after generations, the plants become adapted and specialized to the particular area that they're grown in. And, it's kind of a process of elimination. You get the best and tastiest. And each one of these sports, this biodiversity, is the opposite of monocropping, which is what we now have under industrialized agriculture. That means a single disease or a single insect can come in and destroy your entire crop. One quick example. There's a UB99. It's a wheat stem rust in the Horn of Africa. It's virulent. It kills wheat within 2 weeks. Destroys it. We have a monocrop of wheat here. If by any means some of those spores got into this country and somebody went down I-80, within days or weeks, the entire food production of wheat, our bread, everything, would be gone. That's like taking out this country with a single missile, but you can do it for less than the Cash for Clunkers program. You forget all of the hypnotic trance we're in about defense and missiles and all of this other kind of miasma that we're all marching along. It's that simple. The single most important human event is the annual harvest. And I'd like to repeat that over and over until everybody else that's not involved in feeding themselves and others gets it that they're not first in line. And they'd be out there making $500,000 a year and whoop-de-doo going up and down the freeway right now. But if they don't eat, the illusion comes home to roost. We have got to get back to the understanding that the patriot farmer, and that can be in your backyard, it can be a tomato plant. We've got signs popping up in the back windows of cars all over the city. It just says 1,000 gardens. Because there's a lot of pride coming back with people understanding that he who controls the food on your plate controls your destiny.
And we will end right there, Galen Chadwick.
Thank you so much.
Tell people how to learn more about what you're doing.
Well, you can talk to us anytime. We just stuck our toe in the water this morning.
I know. We'll have you on again because you're a wealth of information and knowledge.
Well,
but give out your website for us.
Please, it's www.wellfedneighbor.com. And it's going to be upgraded and made interactive here pretty soon. We're just conducting an interview in the other part of the room right now with a new webmaster coming on board that's going to help us take it national. And we're here to help each person listening to take the next step, whatever that is for them. We're totally into the service of this. We've all got other jobs and lives to perform, but this right now is the critical burning issue of our lives and our time. You find out how much food you've actually got in your city. If that supply line is cut, somebody down there better start doing some thinking. So anyhow, that's all from the Ozarks.
Thank you, Galen Chadwick and Rural Chapel from WellFedNeighbor.com.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye. And now we have in our studio Mike Lachey.
Mike is here to keep us up to snuff on what's going on with the bicycle pedestrian advocacy.
Well, actually, I'm here this morning to talk about something new we haven't brought to this, and I've brought along a guest with me. I brought along Matthew Reynolds, And what Matthew and I have been doing, along with a number of other people, probably a cast of hundreds, is over the last, how many years, Matthew? 4 or 5 years?
Actually, it's been going on in one way or another for nearly 20 years.
That's right.
Beginning with the Neighborhood Association, but there is a very real chance that we could complete this long process here soon and get ourselves another great park in the city of Sarasota.
The basic idea is that in the Bayshore neighborhood, just south of the museum, there is an 8.3-acre parcel of undeveloped land, and it was originally called Rus in Urb. That's Latin for country in the city. And this neighborhood does not have a park. I mean, you look around the city, you see big parks like Gillespie Park and Arlington Park, but this neighborhood, north of Whitaker Bayou and west of the trail, does not have a large park. And what's great about this could be one of the Sarasota's great parks. And the people behind it include the Neighborhood Association, representing 1,200 property owners, 60 people who signed letters for this. We've got the owners of the property, the developers. They want to sell it as well. They would like to see it become a park as well. They're working with us on this. And we're going before the Board of County Commissioners. I just got the email on this morning. The Board of County Commissioners will be considering this on November 10th, about 9 a.m. And we're not quite sure if there's going to be a big discussion on it or not, but the big decision, the key decision is will they buy the whole 8.3, will they influence, they're going to actually set in motion the process, I shouldn't say they're going to buy it then, to buy the whole 8.3 acres, to buy 5 acres or just 3 acres of it. And that's really where we are right now. Let me say this, we've come a long way. All those people were involved, and we've come through the county's parks bureaucracy, the committees, we've gone through the city's parks committee twice, we've gone through the city commission, now the county parks and recreational staff, they're all in support of having this as a park, and so we're on the cusp of really achieving a great park right in this neighborhood.
And what do you see for this park? What do you envision?
Well, I mean, the thing is, I mean, one thing to understand is it will be owned by the county.
Mm-hmm.
So the county is going to be the manager. So it's really kind of irrelevant in a sense what I see about it, but or what anybody else sees about it. But most people have been talking. I'm sure they're going to listen to public input. They've been talking about what they call a passive park. Something, you know, they're not talking about baseball fields and
that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, okay. Talking about more like trees and open space. I mean,
mm-hmm.
That's
a green space.
That's what most of the neighbors are talking about so far. But of course, I don't want to guarantee anything. What I would like to say is that what we're here this morning to do is we're here to ask for the people out there in Radioland to help us out, because Matthew just built a smashing website. It's called IndianBeachPark.com, and what we want people to do. By the way, this park is about a couple hundred yards from the SLR studio. So.
Oh, okay.
So whereabouts is it going to be exactly?
Well, do you know if you go to Jungle Gardens on Bayshore mm-hmm. Road, head north 3 or 4 blocks. It's on your right.
Is that what was called the Emerald Forest? For
exactly
a while?
What was okay. called the Emerald Forest. Yep, exactly that. And what we want y'all to do is go to IndianBeachPark.com, and there's a way there. You can sign a letter. You can fill out a form. And you can send a letter to the county commissioners and to the county staff. Matthew, there's a form there. What else? You know, what else can they do?
There's information there about fundraising for the park. There's information about there's email addresses for your county commissioners and parks department folks. And this is going to come up for a decision for the next stage by the county in the next 30 days or so.
November 10th.
November 10th, we have a date. Oh, great. So about a month from now, the county commission will be meeting and deciding on this, deciding how much of this to buy and how much of a priority to make it. And we need the support of literally hundreds of people in the community to let them know that it is really important for us to have another park in the city. Sarasota is not particularly well provided with city parks in the city limits, and it's something that we should really be working on.
And that's a great place close to the Ringling School and New College. I thought they had already started development on that, though, a few years back.
They have started development, but the great thing about it is the development they've done makes it perfect for a park. They've got a road through the middle of it, so it's no problem with security, for police security. They've got all the drainage, all the sewer, all the gray water, all the electricity, all the everything you need. All you really need to make this a great park is a sign and some benches.
I mean, so when you say that November the 10th there's going to be a meeting on it, supposing that comes out positively, how far do you see it being actually becoming a park or completed?
According to county staff, it takes 4 months for them, after a successful decision, a positive decision on the 10th, it takes 4 months for them to go through the appraisal process and then to make an offer to the owners. And what the great thing is, now we're at a low real estate market. This should actually be a good bargain for the county at this point to buy, because I think certainly the owners are realistic about this too. They know everyone knows we're in a down real estate market.
Yeah, back a few years ago when there was a move to turn this into a park, it was very, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be a lot less expensive now. So nothing really needs to be done to it, and nothing has been destroyed in the development so far.
Large road was put through the middle of it. If it had originally been planned as a park, it wouldn't have needed as much clearing or as much of a roadway as was actually put through there. It would have been lovely to have it preserved with more of what was there originally. But there are still hundreds of large trees on the property, and there has been some very nice high quality new planting put in just recently in the last year.
How big is the property?
It's 8.3 acres, and that's the real rub of the decision on the 10th. I mean, that's where the influence would come in, because we in the neighborhood would like to see all 8.3 acres bought. The county, as always, they plead money, and see, they might have a different vision than we have. We have a vision of a great park. They have a vision of buying little parklands in several neighborhoods. So they might want to buy just 3 acres or just 5 acres, and so we're trying to get public support to buy the 8.3 acres. Along that line, regarding fundraising, there's no science here, but we believe one thing we'd like to also do an appeal for, should anybody out there be able to do this, we believe that a large private donation of, say, $1 million or $1.5 million would guarantee that all 8.3 acres would be bought. I think if someone went to the county commission and said, hey, here's $1 million, for if you will buy the whole 8.3, I'll put it towards the effort, or $1.5 million, I would bet that would cause it to be bought. If someone came in with $500,000, you can almost guarantee they'd buy the 5 acres.
Well, the property is in an affluent neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
You would think that perhaps maybe you could get the neighbors rallying together to do a fund drive for this.
That's why we're on WSLR.
Now, you say that the name is Emerald Forest, which sounds absolutely beautiful. Is it a very wooded area?
I think, in my opinion, with the basics of good park management, it would be a showcase for Florida, I guess the Florida environment, Florida wildlife. You would have the plants coming back with just a little bit of management. It would be a wonderful open space and just demonstration of what old Florida was like.
And very, very accessible for everybody, too. What has been done already provides for any future use. One could imagine almost there's.
I know of a couple of the parks more towards downtown. Are there any other parks around in this area to speak of?
There are no large parks north of Whitaker Bayou, west of Tammany Trail. You have a park on the east side of trail, North Water Tower Park, which is big, but that's not really that neighborhood. And in that neighborhood, you've got three kind of very small sorts of strips of land. There's one along the intersection of Indian Beach and Bayshore, a beach. And then there's one in Sapphire Shores, which is kind of a dog walking park. What the city's plan is called a tot lot. And then and then there's another little strip of land at the north end of Sarasota Avenue, which is just essentially where two houses used to be. So this is a great neighborhood without a great park.
It's the largest neighborhood in the city. There's over 1,200 families living in the Indian Beach Sapphire Shores neighborhood. And the largest neighborhood association in the city.
And it's within walking distance or easy cycling distance from New College.
It's the park would
or
be
Ringling.
Almost exactly halfway
or
between Ringling.
Or East-West College, that's right.
Ringling and New College. There's a lot of facilities in the neighborhood like that draw a lot of people here. And this park, I'm sure nobody's going to be complaining 20 or 30 years from now that, the park's too big.
Well, that's for sure.
When was the last time you heard that?
I would have thought that now, a lot of people are unemployed and have more time on their hands. I would think recreational areas like that is something, we really need. It's good for people to get out and be in nature.
I'd like to especially remind everybody who, there were hundreds of people here in Sarasota who worked quite hard and came out in support of this endeavor about 4 years ago, when the city commission had its longest hearing on record. It was two full evenings, and then a bit of a third. It was almost 13 hours spent discussing this particular whether to allow this to be developed, whether to buy it and turn it into a park. And I'd like to encourage everybody who worked on that and felt like, oh, that was a lost cause, that that we didn't succeed at, to realize that, first of all, that entire effort led to the program to purchase environmentally sensitive lands and urban park spaces, which was very successful, and we're one of the leading counties in the nation in terms of per capita expenditure on this. And the money is there to buy urban park space and to buy more environmentally sensitive lands. And not only that, but the effort that was made then, you know, has resulted in where we are today, which is the opportunity to actually follow through and complete this project.
Matthew, we are just about out of time. How can people learn more?
They can check the website, IndianBeachPark.com, and we've been mailing folks out, and we will try to get the word out as best we can. Encourage people to write letters to the editor about this. That's a very powerful way to reach the rest of the community. They may not be hearing us or may not be getting our emails. So please help us out and follow up on this, because your letter counts, your phone call counts.
Come to the website and join the effort. I mean, sign up and join the effort, and we'll have you on our emailing list, and we'll be able to, and hopefully all of us together can push this thing through. Let me say one other thing, which I think will be of news to all our environmental friends. This afternoon, 11:30, Tiger Bay is hosting the two main sponsors of Florida Hometown Democracy. We'll be there speaking. They'll be in the Tiger's Den, the Lion's Den, speaking about Florida Hometown Democracy. So anyone who wants to attend that at Michael's on East, it should be. You'll have the developers versus the environmentalists this afternoon.
Oh, that sounds exciting.
Yeah, at 11:30 at Michael's on East.
You know, hearing all this today, we had our previous guests talking about the importance of growing our own food. You're talking about the importance of parks and open space, and I think it reminds me of a very good film called How Cuba Survived Peak Oil. And you can actually just watch it online. And it really shows the importance of all our green space that we have around us and how we should be utilizing it, either for recreation and aesthetic beauty or for food supplies. And I think it's really good, all these different organizations trying to bring this awareness and, you know, put the stuff to good use rather than either letting it go to ruin or development that then just goes to ruin.
Well, thank you for listening to Truly Sustainable Sarasota. I'm Vicki Chelf. My co-host is Emily Berno. We were just talking with Mike Lachey and Matthew
Reynolds.
And please tune in again next week and stay tuned for Elizabeth Van Riper with The Creative Life.
Thanks for letting us on.
Thank you.